From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Wes Craven. Craven is responsible for one of the most shocking horror movies, The Last House on the Left, and one of the most commercially successful, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Also today, I talk with writer Alice McDermott. Her new novel, That Night, is about the hidden dangers in the suburbia of the early 60s. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews King's Record Shop, the latest album from Roseanne Cash. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Living Daylights, the new James Bond movie, starring Timothy Dalton as the new James Bond. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Wes Craven, one of today's top horror film directors. His credits include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Deadly Friend. His first film, The Last House on the Left, advanced the genre to a new level of gruesome violence. It graphically and realistically depicted two teenage girls being raped, tortured, and killed by psychotic escaped convicts. The film truly horrified not only viewers, but industry insiders. Though it became a cult classic, it didn't win Craven contracts for major motion pictures. He made several more genre films that started to receive praise from some critics for their eccentricity, their ironic edge, and for how deeply felt his vision was. Wes Craven has said of movie watching that it's like dreaming. He said, when people go into a theater and they shut off the lights, it's as if they're entering the darkness of sleep and dreams. To me, a good horror film should be just that, a compelling dream. The box office success of Nightmare on Elm Street has allowed Craven to start to move beyond the genre. He recently finished shooting his next film, a suspense thriller titled The Serpent and the Rainbow. It's set in Haiti and is based on the story of a Harvard student who finds a scientific fact to support voodoo magic, but then winds up being pursued by voodoo priests. Wes Craven, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
And I should mention,
nice to be here.
I should mention that you're joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles.
That's correct, and the weather is fine out here. I hope it is there.
Many directors start making horror movies as a way just to break into the industry. It's not really that they want to be making horror movies. What about you? Did you start for that reason, or did you really like horror films?
No, as a matter of fact, I wasn't aware of the genre. I was simply trying to break into the film business, as everyone else is, waitresses and all. And a horror film was the first sort of film that was presented to me as an opportunity. I had no knowledge of them before that. I really did not. I was more immersing myself in the work of the European directors and the Fellinis and Bergmans and so forth. But I found I had an affinity for it that even surprised me. I didn't know until I started doing it that I could do it rather well.
So you were approached to do The Last House on the Left?
Yeah, that's right. I was working, just learning the film business. I was literally in the business about a year and a half from not knowing a thing about it. And I was working my way up through the editing room and got an opportunity to work on a small feature that allowed me to do some directing, some writing, and some editing at a point where I knew virtually nothing about making a cut or writing a script. And that film was successful, and as a result, the producer, who was Sean Cunningham at that time, a very, very young guy who was also just starting, Sean was offered by the distributor the chance of making a horror film for them to fill their summer bill. And Sean offered me the chance to write it, direct it, and cut it. We were close friends. We were working out of one small office on 45th Street in New York, and the two of us were going to set off and make this film for a very small amount of money. We made it for $90,000. And our entire concept was to maybe clear $10,000 out of the budget to pay our own home bills. And instead, the film caused a sensation and took off at the box office, and we became sort of notorious. Well, and I was in one swell swoop, a director of some sort.
Well, it caused a sensation because it was just so gruesome and realistic. You know, a lot of violence in horror movies is really very campy, and it doesn't really hurt. But the violence in Last House on the Left and the scenes of rape and mutilation and torture are so intense. I mean, I ended up walking out of the theater for that scene because I just felt that I didn't want to have to remember it. if I saw it. And I wonder if that's the challenge that you took on for yourself, to make something more graphic and more realistic than it had ever been done before.
It was. It was very specifically the philosophy of it. You know, I had a certain ambivalence towards doing this sort of genre. As I said, it was not something that I loved. But I was intrigued by the idea of presenting anything that was exceptionally truthful, because I felt that most of the films that I'd seen that were made in America for popular audiences were distortions, and quite often would present violence in a way that was either operatic or balladic or simply elliptic, so that, you know, you would fade away before any true violence was done, or the act of violence would be very simple and antiseptic. Someone would be shot, clutch his chest, and fall down and die. A stab wound, you know, always killed with the first thrust. And parallel to the process of filmmaking, in my own mind and in the minds of Sean too, were the mass of media inputs from the Vietnam War, and where we were seeing the first results of ourselves and the whole American public being exposed to the realities of war on a sort of real-time basis. Whereas you saw people suffered. It wasn't edited. The government didn't have enough facilities to filter it all out, so that we were seeing reality of violence on our television sets, going into our theaters and seeing distorted, filtered reality. So that Sean and I set off to say simply, let's not cut away, and let's not do violence that is entertaining. And I didn't. You know, I simply did not cut away. And one stab did not do it, and one shot did not do it. And at the time that most other movies would cut away so people could safely ensconce themselves in the next scene and sort of forget about the reality of it, we kept going. And we did that within the format of a B-movie. Now, you know, we were two pretty mature men. We were 30 when we did this. We were not kids. We had a very real plan in mind. We were working within the basis of a B-movie, very almost cartoonish characters. But once the violence began, the violence was treated absolutely really. And thus the outrage. The audiences were, in a sense, tricked. They went into a movie expecting to be entertained in the pure action or horror sense, where the blood is ketchup and the violence is simple and cartoonish. And instead, we said, now that we've got you here, by the way, this is what violence is really like.
What's the benefits of seeing that, though?
I think the benefits of seeing that is that it reaffirms reality rather than reaffirming a fantasy. Too much of American cinema dealt with reaffirming fantasies. It was a Disney-like approach to the entire spectrum of our reality. And at the same time, in the real world, quote, whatever the hell that is, we were seeing more and more of the veils stripped away, you know. The myth of American supremacy and infallibility, the myth of, you know, bombs dropped to win wars and you don't see the people that they hit, the reality that the American soldier was heroic and in all cases and never did anything that was terribly disturbing. All those were being stripped away in the public forum, but in cinema, we're still desperately trying to reaffirm the myths. And my feeling was, it's time to stop dreaming. And I guess that's become the theme of my entire work. It's time to wake up.
I think in some ways that Last House on the Left became a forerunner of slasher films. And I wonder if you think that other film directors have taken the kind of graphic violence that you started to extremes that you find disturbing.
Well, I don't think it really was a forerunner to slasher films. I mean, there were the films of Stuart Gordon a long time before I made Last House. I think it more or less stands on its own. I mean, the genre in the sense of, you know, a man with a knife has been around. Hitchcock did it. And, you know, Hitchcock always boasted that you never saw the knife touch the flesh. Well, in my mind, as good as Hitchcock was, and I would never deny his genius, he denied the essence of the moment. And I always go on, there was a French philosopher that once said, it's all right to lie, that's what art is all about, but it's not all right to lie about the essence of the matter. And I've used that as my credo making films.
So you don't think that other people have taken what you've done to extremes that disturb you?
No, I don't. I don't think other people are that weak or, you know, are artistic Xeroxes. I think everybody goes off and does their own vision. And I don't take responsibility for other people's work, frankly. It's bad enough taking responsibility for my own.
Well, has that been hard? I mean, really? Have people made false assumptions about you based on your movies?
I don't know whether they're false or true. I mean, you know, sometimes the truth hurts too. But I certainly have had my experiences of people getting up and walking away, not only from my movies, but from me. You know, I was anathema in polite society after I made Last House. People literally would grab their children and run from the room. And I always found it an irony that, you know, the same people that would support a war or, you know, live a lifestyle that would require entire third world countries to be put in near slavery would at the same time be appalled by somebody that did something that was only effective within a certain closed dark room called a movie house. It was very interesting.
Director,
but, yes, I've experienced a great deal of, you know, ostracism from making of films. It's only been in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that I've received real nice things from it.
Director Wes Craven is my guest. You know, it seems to me that although you started doing this very almost documentary style portrayals of violence, that the violence in your movies has gotten more movie-like.
Mm-hmm.
In, for instance, Nightmare on Elm Street and Deadly Friend. I don't know if you'd agree with that. But
would agree with it in the sense that, you know, I've thought about it myself. I could give you lots of artistic reasons, but I've also wondered whether, as Lena Wertmüller once said, you must the one thing the artist must never lose is his rage. Maybe I've lost some of my rage. I don't know. I think Last House was specifically about real violence. I don't think of that film as a horror film. I think of horror films as sort of about not real life, you know, about the area of fantasy and dreams. Last House was about real violence that people really do to each other, and the capacity for it within the most staid, middle-class breast. And that was why the tables turned in that movie, and at the end the parents were just as violent as the escaped psychopaths, you know. The later films, Nightmare on Elm Street, for instance, was much more about psychic consciousness, and I'm not into some sort of weird cult, I'm a very ordinary guy, but, you know, I feel very much like the real stakes that are going on in the planet, insofar as humankind is concerned, is consciousness. Are we going to be awake or are we going to be asleep? And the only way to get rid of the boogeyman is to stay awake, not to fall asleep, not to try to dream him away.
Yeah, that's what happens in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Everyone's warned not to fall asleep because this group of teenagers share the same nightmare. They have this nightmare of a mutilated killer who attacks them in their dreams, but the attacks that he carries out in their dreams carry over into their real life. So when they're stabbed in their sleep, they bleed in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Is this in a way the fulfillment of your theory that horror films are like nightmares?
Well, I think it's more like I think our dreams become our realities. I carry it much more into waking life.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as our most subtle and unbounded imagination produces things, we must deal with them within real life. And insofar as we neglect them, whether they be horrific thoughts or tendencies or impulses or whatever, so to the extent that we neglect them and try to go off into the various exits that the characters in Nightmare used, except for the heroine, that is sex, booze, you know, family, solidity, whatever it might be, all those people were denying the reality and saying, you know, this is reality. Only one person was willing to face it, and that is the only person that survived. So I'm saying, you know, not that, you know, nightmares are like dreams. It's our dreams must be dealt with. Our most innermost uncensored impulses must be dealt with, must be worked out in real life, within our lives. And that's, you know, to me, the thrill of making films for a young audience is that I am sort of writing scenarios for the apocalypse. You know, I'm dealing with very primal, raw energies and trying to put some form on them. And I really, truly believe that that is, as much as anything else, why my audience likes my films. Not that they're just bloody and scary, although that is a thrill, but that they have some inner sense to them. They've been thought through, and they are not black. They are they're strangely hopeful. You know, my characters survive not because of some fluke of luck, but they survive because they figure out what's going on and they figure out a way to deal with it within the capacities of their human spirit. And they have to plumb to the very depths of it and come up with the best and the brightest of it. You know, Nancy doesn't kill Freddy at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street by picking up a bigger gun or inventing Star Wars. She kills him by turning her back on him. You know, and that's a pretty subtle and I think profound thought. It's not one that I came up with. You know, it's one that I found in my own readings and listenings. But, you know, it's an important notion.
Well, I want to talk more about your movies, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is film director Wes Craven. His movies include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, and Nightmare on Elm Street. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is film director Wes Craven, who's joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. You said earlier on in our conversation that you initially didn't want to get into horror movies. It was just your way of getting into the film industry. Now that you've had some big successes like Nightmare on Elm Street, are you trying to get out of that genre?
Well, I would love for people to say, you know, filmmaker Wes Craven instead of horror film director. So to the extent that I would like to feel less bounded, that I could have people come to me with projects that are not considered a horror film, that's important to me. I hate being restricted by myself, by other people's concept of me. So, yeah, I would like to get out of horror films. I would never have liked to have been in them. I don't like my films, as I said, classified as horror films per se. They're films. They're Wes Craven films.
You know, well, Wes Craven, you are from, I understand, from a fundamentalist Baptist background, and you had a pretty strict upbringing. And
oh, well, that explains it all.
No. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you. No.
I'm smiling.
No, okay. No, but I wonder, you know, if... it does seem to me, however, that you did kind of get a chance to unleash some pent-up feelings when you got into the horror film genre. I mean, for a man who didn't even get to see any movies till he was in college, you really went at it once you got into them yourself.
That's true. And I'm sure that did have a very profound influence on my energies and mind. You know, it's a lifestyle. I mean, I don't want to defame any religion or religious posture, but it is one based on, a view of the world that is very dark, very prescriptive, proscriptive, and, can leave you with a tremendous sense of rage once you're out of it, because you feel like you've been denied your youth, your joy. To religion, this is all our righteousness is like filthy rags. I mean, if you look at yourself like that, you have a very dark view of yourself, and you have a very dark, almost throwaway view of the entire world. And it's something that I've had to grow out the rest of my life, grow out of, you know.
What made you fall in love with movies when you started to see them?
They're so beautiful. I don't know. I always had an active dream life, and there's something so profound and wonderful about a movie. It's so alive. It's so shared. The thing of sitting in an audience and going into a dreamlike state with several hundred other people that are sharing exactly what you're feeling is a profound event. I think it's really, to me, it simply was something that nothing else quite did for me. And it also was something that I proved after many years of sort of searching for a voice. I mean, I did many things in my life. I painted and I played guitar and... wrote and did many, many things, but it all seemed to come together in making movies, and almost accidentally. I was pursuing a career in writing and went to New York to make movies almost out of desperation of finding something that I really felt happy at, and all of a sudden I just was good at it really fast. I made my first feature, you know, a year and a half after not knowing anything about making a movie whatsoever. So it simply was there, and I was there, and we crossed, and it was love at first sight between me and movies.
You're working on a new film now, The Serpent and the Rainbow, that's based on a book of the same name, about a Harvard graduate student who goes down to Haiti and uncovers what he thinks is the biological secret behind zombies. At least
yes.
That's what the book was about. I haven't seen the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So you were shooting on location in Haiti, and I can't think of many films that have been shot there. There's been a lot of political upheaval there lately. Did that affect the making of the film at all?
Yes. First of all, let me just thumbnail the movie. Wade Davis was a Harvard ethnobotanist, and he was commissioned by a large pharmaceutical company in a rather secret expedition to go to Haiti and find the sort of botanical reason behind the creation of zombies. And I just wanted to say about zombies, I mean, as soon as you say the word, you think B-movies and think of, you know, Boris Karloff or whatever. Recently, several zombies have been discovered. That is, people who were authenticated having died and been buried and later found alive. I personally met one, 17-year-old zombie, quote, by the name of Rosemary. What they are, as it turned out after extensive research, is people that have been poisoned by a very subtle, very powerful neurotoxin that gives them all appearances of death. Their heartbeat, their respiration, and all other vital signs go down to the point where they cannot be determined by a typical rural doctor. The person is buried, and in the middle of the night is still alive, still fully conscious, although showing no signs of life, is dug back up, further poisoned, beaten, and quite often sold into slavery in Haiti and for the work in the cane fields, all part of a tribal system of judgment. It's their form of capital punishment within voodoo. So rather than thinking of zombies, think of somebody who's been poisoned by a neurotoxin and appeared to be dead but was not and has then returned to the living as a brain-damaged person with all of their volitional centers destroyed. That is what a zombie truly is. And this movie is about that actual factual process. The process existed for centuries and then was distorted by Duvalier, Papa Doc Duvalier, and used as a tool of political oppression. If you spoke out too harshly against his government, you would be dragged from your house in the middle of the night and made into a zombie. And there could be no more compelling or terrifying symbol of the power of Duvalier than a person who wished for freedom suddenly turned into a zombie which has no will whatsoever. So this movie is about that process, and it's a quite a factual movie, but it's set within the world of real voodoo and has that sort of phantasmagoric element to it, because voodoo goes very freely into the subconscious and into the netherworld between life and death.
What was it like filming in Haiti?
Filming in Haiti was bifold. I mean, on one hand, the Haitian people are some of the most beautiful and gracious people I've ever met. And taken individually, they're wonderful, marvelous people. Within a group of more than six or eight, they can very quickly develop a sense of outrage and wanting to tear the house down because they've been oppressed so severely and most recently, released from this. So that when we were dealing with large crowds, and we had some scenes dealing with 4,000 people, we ended up in very dangerous situations. We ended up once having to evacuate our crew into a missionary compound in a small village far removed from any help. And the producer and I had to go out and deal with 4,000 chanting, very angry people who were started picking up stones and threatened to destroy us and our equipment and everything else. I mean, they are very unhappy, rightfully so, people. And it was a very... a very volatile situation. We had a.
Were you perceived as the exploiter, as the filmmaker there?
Not at first. I mean, we went in with, with all attempts to say we are bringing work and jobs and everything else. But what happened is an unfortunate event of the people have been deprived for so long that that any show of money whatsoever becomes sort of what they perceive as the beginning of the gold mine opening up.
We only have a few seconds left, but when is the film scheduled to open? Do you know?
We're hoping to open it next January on Martin Luther King's birthday.
One last question. You know, a lot of your movies have probably are about dreams and have probably affected the dreams of the people who've gone to see them. And I wonder if your dreams are ever affected by the movies that you're making.
They always are. I mean, as I said, I have an active dream life, and I don't say that glibly. I, over the years, have developed my process of dreaming to the point that it is functional. And when I'm working on a script or a movie, that filters right down into my dreams, and I quite often dream quite intact and usable portions of films, sometimes quite sizable portions of films or scenes. And it was a natural progression as that developed for my films to get more and more into the dream state.
Can you give Nightmare us an example of a... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's just the concept of Nightmare on Elm Street came out of my own dreams. The whole structure of Hills of Eyes, for instance, came out of one dream.
What was the dream?
Well, the dream was specifically started with the concept of the two dogs, Beauty and the Beast. And from that spread out to a concept of... that there would be two forces represented in the film, that would be the bestial and the beautiful, and that they would intertwine to the extent that each family would mirror the other. There would be a father in each, there'd be a mother in each, there'd be children in each, there'd be pet animals in each. And at a certain point, the polarity would switch so that what was perceived as the good family would become the evil family. What was the gentle family would become the savage family. And vice versa, the savage family at certain points would take on pathos. And, you know, that concept of turning the duality around and around until you no longer felt comfortable thinking that there was a duality you could deal with and had to look at things in the round, that was the basic concept that came out of the dream. It was very clear-formed, and it became sort of the backbone of the structure of the film.
Do you ever have nightmares based on movies that you're working on? Do your movies ever scare you?
They scare me when I'm writing them. That's about the most alone that I ever get with them. The rest of the time is a process surrounded by so many people that you know, that you sort of lose that, and you have to struggle to maintain it so you can understand what will be scary in that gross sense. But when I'm writing, if I'm writing a scene where I'm right in the middle of it alone by myself in a dark room, somebody comes up behind me, I will jump right out of my seat because at that point they're full-blown, you know. While they're still in your mind, they're the most intact and the most powerful. By the time they get onto film, they're diminished by 10,000 factors, you know. They're still pretty scary, but you should see what's in my head.
Well, what is in your head?
I get paid for telling people that.
Ah, okay. Well, Wes Craven, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been film director Wes Craven, whose credits include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, and A Nightmare on Elm Street. Craven's next film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, is about voodoo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Erica Jong, author of the best-selling novels Fear of Flying and Serenissima, so I hope you can join us. Here's some music from A Nightmare on Elm Street. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Alice McDermott talks about her new novel, That Night. It's about the outside world beginning to penetrate 1960s suburbia. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Roseanne Cash album, King's Record Shop. And movie critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Living Daylights, the 15th film installment in The Adventures of James Bond. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from singer Roseanne Cash called King's Record Shop. On this album, you can hear Cash's country and rock and roll roots. This is Cash singing Rosie Strikes Back.
A bruiser, he loves to tease you. He's a loser, you think he needs you. You always come back, you always come back for more. He winds up tight, out all night. Been drinking now, he's looking for a fight. He knocks you down, you don't even know what for. Rosie strike back, Rosie strike back.
Roseanne Cash is the daughter of Johnny Cash, an identification she probably wishes I would forget after five albums of her own strong music. Nonetheless, it's the Cash brand name that brought Roseanne attention when she released her first album in 1979. It's also just about the only reason I can think of why she's still considered a pure country artist. At 32, Cash is young enough to have grown up at a time when country music and rock and roll got all mixed up together by Graham Parsons and the Byrds in the 60s, and country rock was born. Roseanne Cash's kind of country rock avoids all of the macho posturing and hard-boiled overstatement that came to characterize this movement in the 70s. Her songs are most often about one-sided love affairs. For example, her big hit last year was a tune called I Don't Know Why You Don't Want Me. At its best, Roseanne Cash's music doesn't fit into any particular category. All of her commercial success has been on country radio, but that's by definition a rather compromised success, since country music doesn't receive much exposure in the big cities that shape pop music taste. This is unfortunate for an artist like Cash, who can make very clear the country roots in a song like The Way We Make a Broken Heart, while staying true to its essentially rock and roll inspiration.
Just one more kiss, she'll have to miss this night with you. Now you're guilty of this secret love, as I am too. You're getting used to telling lies, feeling sorry when she cries. Now that the strings are attached, she'll catch on. We've done our part. Oh, and this is the way we make a broken heart. Lesson number one, we've just begun to hurt her soul. And with lesson two, she'll long for you when lights are. Before she comes apart. Oh, this is the way we make a broken heart. Now we've laid it there'll be no more for her to bear. And on some dark night we'll dim the lights of this affair. Then she'll find somebody new, and he'll likely hurt her too. 'Cause there must be millions just like you and me, practiced in the art.
That was Roseanne Cash and The Way We Make a Broken Heart from her new album, King's Record Shop. That song was written by John Hiatt. Those of you who pay attention in this class will remember that we discussed him a few weeks ago. Hiatt and Cash are really part of the same tendency, pop artists making the music they want to hear and letting someone else label it as country or rock or whatever. In the song I just played, you can hear influences ranging from Marty Robbins to The Drifters. The song sounds to me like a cross between El Paso and Under the Boardwalk, which is one reason I think it's a good song. You can also pick out influences in Cash's vocal style. I hear a little Dusty Springfield, a little early Linda Ronstadt. But after 5 albums, Roseanne Cash has formed her own style. Her voice is an almost expressionless, rather flat instrument. She gets her best effects by phrasing in a conversational manner. Ultimately, I think she achieves the sort of stoic, terse tone that has characterized some of the best country music throughout history, while feeling free to tap the loose humor of rock when it suits her, which is probably the way to make country rock serve your own purposes.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed King's Record Shop, the new album by Roseanne Cash.
I'm worried about you. I'm worried about me. The curves around midnight aren't easy to see. Flashing red warnings unseen in the rain.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Alice McDermott. Her second novel, That Night, takes place in the early 60s in a new suburban Long Island neighborhood. Reviewing That Night for the New York Times, David Levitt wrote that this brief lyrical novel is a kind of elegy to both childhood in suburbia and the childhood of suburbia. What distinguishes this novel from the mass of literature that takes on the barely middle-class suburban experience is the intellectual complexity of McDermott's moral vision and the explicit emotion of her voice. The story is told by a 30-year-old woman recalling an incident that she witnessed when she was 10, the night that a local hood and his gang drove onto the block to force his girlfriend's mother to let him see her. When I spoke with Alice McDermott, I asked her to read the opening of her novel.
That night when he came to claim her, he stood on the short lawn before her house, his knees bent, his fists driven into his thighs, and bellowed her name with such passion that even the friends who surrounded him, who had come to support him, to drag her from the house, to murder her family if they had to, let the chains they carried go limp in their hands. "This is serious," my own father remembered thinking at that moment. "This is insane." I remember only that my 10-year-old heart was stopped by the beauty of it all.
Was there a story in your life, like the story at the center of the novel, the story of a teenage girl who falls in love with a hood?
There was an incident in the neighborhood where I grew up that I didn't witness. And no one I've since spoken to has the story quite straight. Apparently there were the teenage couple who lived not too far from us who had eloped. And after they'd eloped, I suppose the girl had second thoughts and returned to her parents' house. And her then husband came to the house one evening to try to get her. And what struck me about the incident and why I even knew anything about it was that it was an incident that was cited any number of times as I was growing up by people in the neighborhood when they were trying to illustrate what kind of neighborhood this was. They would talk about this night when there wasn't actually a fight. There was just an argument out on the front lawn between this girl's parents and this boy. But everyone in the neighborhood was ready to do whatever they had to do. And I discovered that many separate people I knew would remember that incident and cite that incident to say this was the character of our neighborhood. So it seemed to me it was a good place to start.
What would that say about the neighborhood?
Well, I think it was just that it was the piece of it, that this was an aberration, that something like this would happen.
I think that sitcoms and movies that are about growing up in the suburbs in the 1950s and early 1960s are very nostalgic, and they have the sense of, well, those were the days of innocence. And I think in many ways that your novel is the other side. It's about what was forbidden and what was dangerous during those so-called innocent times.
Yeah, well, I think it's important, and I suppose it was something that I always kept in mind as I was composing the novel. I think it's important not to distort what was because of where we're looking at it from. And I think it's also important to realize that although looking back we can say that was a particular time that seemed innocent, we didn't realize what was coming, what changes would take place, that this kind of suburban landscape would eventually change.
In your novel, the hoods have the role of the outlaws in town, and the suburban parents want to keep them out of the block and keep them out of the neighborhood. Do you have memories of that kind of thing from your block?
Not really. Again, mostly through hearsay. The composition of the novel was such that it was more the emotion, the feeling of what looking back is like that really generated all this. And then the characters, I suppose, came from many different places, things I'd seen and things I'd only heard about. But they belong, I think, probably exclusively to the world of the novel.
Toward the beginning, there's a scene where the hoods drive onto the block, and they're there to help support one of the hoods who's coming to claim his girlfriend, who he thinks is being withheld from him by her mother. And all the fathers from the neighborhood come out to ready to fight with the hoods to protect the daughter and the mother. Would you read that scene where the fighting breaks out between the fathers of the neighborhood and the hoods?
Sure. Until then, I had thought all violence was swift and sure-footed, somehow sleek, even elegant. I was surprised to see how poor it really was, how laborious and hulking. I saw one of the men bend under the blow of what seemed a slow-moving chain, and then, just as gracelessly, swing his son's baseball bat into a teenager's ear. I saw the men and the boys leap on one another like obese, short-legged children, sliding and falling, raising chains that seemed to crumble backward onto their shoulders, moving bats and hoes and wide rakes that seemed as unwieldy as trees. There were no clever D'Artagnan mid-air meetings of chain and snow shovel, no eye-to-eye throat grippings, no witty retorts and well-timed dodges, no winners. Only, in the growing darkness, 100 dumb, unrhythmical movements, only blow after artless blow.
I really like that description, and I really like the way it captures how random the violence was and also how unskilled all the participants
yes.
were in doing it. The violence in that scene interrupts the sense of control in the neighborhood. And it seems to me that kind of control is something unique in a way to new suburbs where the families are young, there aren't old people in the neighborhood. And at the beginning, there aren't even teenagers in the neighborhood. And you feel like, well, you can really keep out all of the outside elements.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that was very much the point of those places. You had people who had come from inner cities, or at least had their own childhoods in places that were not quite as safe and comfortable. And so they were well aware of that protection. And again, I think that goes back to why this incident was something that was talked about a great deal when I was growing up, because these were people who were aware of a dangerous world. They had experienced it themselves, and now they had found this haven.
Did writing this novel bring you back to your childhood in the suburbs?
Actually, it didn't. It's been funny since the book has been published. As friends of mine and family have been very reminiscent, and they've started talking about our old neighborhood, and it's made me realize how little I had thought about the neighborhood while I was writing the book, that the neighborhood of the novel seems to me to be something else entirely.
What's the difference between the neighborhood of the novel and the neighborhood you grew up in?
Probably, basically, it's the difference between any reality and what happens to it when it gets to fiction.
When you started to write this, did you think that a suburb like this might be a setting unworthy of fiction, of great fiction?
I certainly have noticed that most fiction, serious fiction, that deals with this kind of neighborhood does it in a slightly disdainful way, or uses sort of shorthand to say what needs to be said about the characters. If a fiction writer tells you that the characters shop at Kmart and eat Wonder Bread, then the writer seems to assume that you know everything you need to know about the characters. And that's always annoyed me. I think that fiction should pay as much good attention to characters from the suburbs as they do from characters from the Deep South and the Maine woods and the streets of Manhattan. And so I suppose in some ways I was attempting to give as much dignity to these characters as I've seen characters in any good fiction have.
Did you have to get old enough and to feel detached and distant enough from your childhood and your own suburban background before you felt that the suburbs could be a worthy setting?
I think that's probably true. And I think especially given the events of the novel, which are fairly simple and even cliched in some ways, there's nothing terribly unusual about what takes place in the novel. And I think years ago, when I was first writing fiction, that would have worried me far too much to even attempt it, that the story is just too familiar.
Well, you know, I have to say, I know what you mean, because in reading your novel, I kept thinking, this is really extraordinary. And in sifting it through my mind, I kept thinking, well, it's a familiar story. It's not exactly the story, it's the writing that's extraordinary.
Well, I hope so. Thank you. But that's, again, that comes back to the idea of paying as much attention to this kind of story and this kind of place as you would to something that on the surface seems much more exciting and interesting.
Alice McDermott's new novel is called That Night. She spoke to us from NPR station KPBS in San Diego. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up on today's program?
Well, tonight, Terry, we'll have a report on a Navajo economic summit. Five senators, two governors, and the heads of some of America's largest corporations gathered last weekend in New Mexico with leaders of the Navajo tribe to figure out ways to make free enterprise work on reservations. Also, teaching Brazil's poor. We have a story tonight on a teacher who takes science to the kids on the streets of Rio. Also, a rookie with the Oakland A's last night hit his 37th home run. And if he keeps going at this rate, he'll break records set by Babe Ruth and Roger Maris.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 25 years since Sean Connery starred in the first James Bond movie, Dr. No. 14 movies and a couple of leading men later, Timothy Dalton is playing the dashing 007 in the latest Bond adventure, The Living Daylights. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
What I like best about James Bond movies is pretty much what I like best about the David Letterman show. I like the props. I like the cars that shoot rockets and shed oil slicks and deflect heat-seeking missiles. I like the rings that spew tear gas and the cameras that spit poison. My favorite single scene is always the one in which Bond gets together with that sour and strangely officious gentleman known only as Q. In case you always get him mixed up with that other sour and strangely officious gentleman known only as M, Q is the guy with the gadgets. In the new James Bond movie, The Living Daylights, Q shows Bond a large radio that at first looks like any other obnoxious beatbox on the beach.
Ah, good! Something we're making for the Americans. It's called a ghetto blaster.
You just heard my favorite scene. Oh, there are other good tricks in The Living Daylights, but frankly, this movie isn't up to par. Things roll along nicely for a good 45 minutes or so. You get the standard amazing opening sequence, and it's amazing enough. You get hairsbreadth escapes and plenty of travel between Czechoslovakia and Morocco. There are two villains. One is Joe Don Baker, a good actor who's trying much too hard here as an evil all-American gun dealer, a sort of Ollie North without the eyebrows. And better yet, there's Jaron Krabbe as a very tricky KGB man. His villainy is like a Eurotrash version of the old snake oil salesman who hides his malign intent behind an ingratiating grin. But about halfway through, the movie takes us to war-torn Afghanistan, and what should be a treasure box of exotic sights and sounds becomes the dullest and dustiest shoot-'em-up in recent memory. The director, John Glenn, seems to be striving for a realism here, but who wants realism in a James Bond movie? That's part of the problem with the new James Bond, too. Timothy Dalton is a fine actor, and he has the right look. Lean and lupine, with the famous cruel smile that Ian Fleming used to go on about. But he's too serious, too ardent, too emotionally vulnerable. Do we really need James Bond as the new sensitive male? He has only one woman on his hands in The Living Daylights, and though Mariam Dabo is swan-like and beautiful, her thespian skills are about what we've come to expect from James Bond actresses. Which is to say, a little of her goes a long, long way.
I won't wait for you.
Fine. Then I'll have Cameron send you direct to London.
You dumb, stubborn, stupid...
What's that supposed to mean?
Fuck end of horse.
You're calling me a horse's ass.
I might never see you again.
You will. I promise.
Is that horse's ass gag meant to make us think that Miss Dabo is clever enough for Bond to take seriously? If so, I'm a little worried about the Timothy Dalton era. The only thing I could take seriously in The Living Daylights was Bond's Aston Martin. When that car dies, at the end of the first 45 minutes or so, the movie dies with it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
Who's up?
Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's program. On tomorrow's show, I'll speak with playwright Adrienne Kennedy. Her new memoir, The People Who Led to My Plays, is about her coming of age as a black middle-class girl wanting to make her life in the arts. Also, singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne drop in to perform a couple of old songs that continue to play well. And Ken Tucker will review several recent home video releases, including Masters of Comic Book Art. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.